Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, connecting the history one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, aloha, mahalo everybody, and Merry Christmas to everyone. I hope everybody is into the season spirit and sharing that joy that comes along this time of year. This is Professor Gary Lee. By now you should know who I am. I've been on the air for now going on 3 years. Every Tuesday night, coming into your home, talking about sport karate and the amazing things that we've done in America from the 1960s to the present. You know, we've had some incredible interviews, not only for the past 2 years, but every show, we always try to do something new and different. Tonight, I have a very, very special show that's close to my heart because I am an active shooter, and I have someone that is really well known in that area, and I'll be bringing him on in just a few minutes. But there is a couple things I would like to share with you before we start. Thank you again for allowing us to be in your home on a Tuesday night. You could be doing anything, I know. But you listen to us, and we appreciate that. And you listen to our podcast. We appreciate the reviews. I certainly appreciate the emails. And I think we're going to start that up again next year, too. That was a lot of fun reading the emails that I've gotten over the time period. I do want to make an announcement that this year Christmas falls on Tuesday, and so does New Year's Eve. So my producer, Hachi Jesse Bowen, and Merry Christmas, Hachi Bowen, he's decided to do a pre-recording of our show. So we'll actually be on the show Christmas night and also New Year's Eve night, but there'll be a pre-recording. Now, he asked me what show I wanted to do, and my all-time favorite show this year was Ricky Smith and Randy Smith, the Goldust Twins out of North Carolina. So we're going to run that show for Christmas. And then for New Year's Eve, I wanted to do something really special, and I really felt that the show that my guest Dean Piles and I did for Thanksgiving and giving thanks to everybody that's contributed to the Sport Karate Museum would be a good show for New Year's Eve. And then we'll be coming back live on, I think it's June 7th or 8th, and we'll be back in your homes on Tuesday night. So stay tuned. We'll still have our show, but it'll be pre-recorded on Christmas night and also New Year's Eve night. So we're excited about that. Also, we have a ongoing contest going on that Hunter Bowen started 2 weeks ago. If you go to our Facebook page, the AMAA Masters Radio Show, and click on the show and you like it and put like, your name will go into a kind of fishbowl type thing, and you'll be drawn to give a hard copy cover book of the Who's Who in the Martial Arts. Now, this is the hard cover, which is like a $79 book. So it's really nice. And all you have to do is go to Facebook and hit like, and your name will be put into the fishbowl. So make sure you do that before the end of the show tonight. The other thing I really want to share with you is that this weekend is the event that we've been advertising for the past 3 or 4 months. And it's the 40th anniversary of the amateur organization of karate, better known as the AOK. They've asked me, and actually they've hired the Sport Karate Museum this year to put together the 40th anniversary and the Golden Greek winners reunion. This is the people who won the Golden Greek from 1981 when we created the Golden Greek Award through the years up to 2018. And this reunion is going to be a lot of fun, a lot of surprises, giveaway of swords and all kinds of cool stuff. Autograph contest, red carpet walk of fame with the past Golden Greek winners, of course, the annual banquet with the AOK State, and all the great competition of black belts and all the incredible children, which is this is the largest sport karate association in Texas for kids, without a doubt. So if you're in Texas, or better off, if you're in Galveston, Texas, on December 14th and 15th, at the Galveston Convention Center, stop by and say hello to me. I'll have my booth there. doing the reunion and just come by and watch some great competition. Galveston is going to be beautiful this weekend. I've already talked to the weatherman, and he said we're not going to have any bad weather. So Galveston is going to be the place to be December 14th and 15th. And the Golden Greek reunion, winners reunion, and the AOK state championship, and the 40th anniversary. Well, my special guest tonight is very, very special. He's a personal friend, a history journal for sport karate, and the best way to introduce him is just a little personal paragraph that we wrote. You know, his name is Paul Pawala, and for the people who don't know who he is, he's a recognized grandmaster, and he's been inducted into 3 Martial Art Hall of Fames. 3. That's pretty impressive. As I said earlier, he's a history journal, and he's actually put in this year for his work that he's done for all these years, you know, for the Sport Karate Museum. He has been in the martial art for, like I said, 47 years. You know, he's retired military, SOCOM hand-to-hand combat instructor, a nationally recognized master police instructor, trainer in firearms and defense tactics, writer of over 100 published magazine articles in self-defense and law enforcement, and over 25 print magazines, and published a Special Forces Sniper Manual considered to be one of the best of all time. Without further ado, my very special guest tonight, Paul Pawala. Hi, Paul.
Sir, it's an honor to be on your radio show.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you, and I've got a lot of cool questions to ask you, and I want to, you know, first of all, just start off with my listeners knowing a little bit about your background in martial arts, and then we can go into the tactical information and stuff. But I want to kind of take my listeners into the beginning part of just wanting to learn how to use a gun. But we'll go into that a little bit later. Let's talk about your history a little bit and how you got involved in the martial arts and who influenced you and what year did you make black belt?
The person that influenced me, number one, the most was my dad, who was a 82nd Airborne 4 Combat Jump Commando in World War II, who was wounded at the Battle of the Bulge. He had 6 brothers that were in World War II as well. His best friend, who married his sister, had 8 brothers, and I had training with all of those people. They really kind of worked me over pretty good all my life, starting in karate and Goju-Ryu at 10 years old until I did that for about 6 years. Then everybody, it was mandatory to do Taekwondo at the time until I joined the service, hit Fort Bragg running at 1980, was thrilled with a man named Michael Enchanis, had all his books, wanted to study with him, but unfortunately he was killed in combat in the 70s, late 70s. So I got his book,
yes,
and
sir.
I just happened to read all of his, who his advisors were. One was Gary O'Neill, and he was at Fort Bragg at the time, as a sergeant first class. I trained with about 4 of Michael Enchanis's certified instructors, and I was going back and forth between Ninpo Ninjutsu with Stephen Hayes and Bud Malmstrom, and I was introduced to Dickie Harrell in North Carolina, who was a student under Larry Hartzell, which started my JKD career. And then I started training with all the JKD guys. So that's pretty much.
You mentioned some amazing lineage right there, Paul, to the people that know the lineage. Michael Chanis, who I remember reading a lot about in Black Belt Magazine, and of course, Stephen Hayes, my dearest friend, and also one of the new advisors for the AMA Masters Radio Alliance. Mr. O'Neill, of course, who's your instructor, and you mentioned some really incredible people that's part of your lineage. You know, the neat thing about people who do what you do now as far as firearms and tactical training, they all started in some form of martial arts. And
absolutely.
That's yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now you did something. I want to bring this up before we go into more depth. You went to Korea, correct?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about that so-called fight in Korea where you impressed some of the Korean people.
Well, when I got to Korea, I was really excited because I was going to finally study Hangwar-do, which was, the the Grandmasters, Ju Bangli, and that's what
Indiana
studied.
Right, Horangdo, yes.
Yeah, and when I got over there, no one knew what the heck I was talking about. So I started finding out that Kuksul Wan was the big martial art over there that was kind of combatives. And the temple for Kuksul Wan was just outside of Pusan, which was where I was stationed. And so I trained every day for a year over there. And then my instructor entered me into a tournament. And what happened, I'm thinking, hey, I'm going to be the ambassador for the United States to Korea. And the guys that I fought did not get the memo that it was a light con. I was the only white guy in the whole community. And this guy was sticking it to me and beating the snot out of me. And finally it dawned on me that it's not going to get any easier. So what I did is on a leg sweep, I swept his leg and pinned his leg on top of my shoulder, which I landed on him and it broke it. And when he let out a large scream, and I had taken his gi and I started smashing his face because I was at this time just so I had lost it and I was so angry. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to get out of this place alive, so I might as well get in my best shots. And we stood in front of after the police broke everything up and my instructor was standing at position of attention in front of the grandmaster of Kuksul Wan and yelling at him in Korean, and it wasn't nice. I'm told when we left, as we were walking, all I wanted to do was get out of there alive, get back to Pusan. As we got back to Pusan, he handed me my black belt and said, "You're a black belt now." So I'm like, "Really? Okay."
That's pretty cool. But you know what? Being old warriors, we all have war stories like that in our memoir and in our past. But you know, the experience going into an Oriental culture, like going to Korea or China or Japan or Okinawa, that had to be very special. And actually, to train with the real masters that were in that area. Well, you know, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just was going to say, I have the honor of being the punching bag to some of the greatest martial artists that have ever lived. So that's kind of my little claim to fame. A lot of people beat me up that were world champions, great martial artists.
I can relate to that. I'm writing a book where most people write about how many times they've knocked people out. My book is about how many times I've been knocked out, so I can relate to what you're saying. So, you know, I'm going to just kind of set up this scenario. You know, I've been a shooter my whole life. I started with a fake piece of wood, turned into a bow and arrow hunting squirrels, and I graduated to a slingshot. And from a slingshot, I graduated to a BB gun. From a BB gun, I graduated to a pellet gun, the pump pellet gun. From there, I graduated to a .22. But before I got the .22, I was hanging out with the game warden. And his name was Joel, and he was very, very proficient, ex-ranger. And he said, before you actually pick up any firearm, you have to spend so many time, so many hours, so many process, protocol at the firing range. And I just thought you went to a firing range to shoot the gun. I didn't realize the protocol and the importance of going to a range at that time. But I literally spent, I guess, 20 hours, 25 hours on the range before he even allowed me to pick up that .22. And from that time on, everybody that I've been around and been lucky to be around, I've always been a sponge to learn more and more about how to handle a firearm. And a lot of people I know don't start like that. Some people just want to pick up a gun and start shooting it. As someone who's asking as a novice, and for listeners who maybe are listening, what would you tell someone if they do want to start learning how to use a firearm? What would be the first procedure that you would share with them what they need to do? Hello? Did I lose your call? Hello? Did I lose the connection? Hello?
I can hear you, Professor, but I don't hear him.
I don't hear him either. So we're actually still on the air then, I guess.
Yes, as far as I know.
Doggone it, this live radio stuff is drives me crazy.
Everybody's still on.
Okay, so you're still on, Hunter Bowen. Okay, cool. All right. But we lost Paul then, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm gonna call him back and make sure he gets on the air here. He just said he got disconnected. I guess it was a problem with his phone. And I apologize to the listeners who are listening right now, but we're going to get back on the air here real quick. It's not not the producer's fault or my fault. It's just the connection that we have with Paul.
He's coming back.
Sorry about that.
So, Paul, where were you?
Yes,
sir. Where'd you go? You go to the bathroom?
I don't know. Disconnected. You can't be doing that.
You can't be faking out an old warrior like me. I done thought I lost you.
Half Southern in me, sir. That's the deadly combination.
It's okay. You know, it's live radio, and it's Murphy's Law, and, you know, we've had worse things happen, so that's nothing. But the most important thing is you're back, and I got Wolverine, so we'll be bringing on in a few minutes. But let's go back to that question, that little break we took. I want to go back to that question. Did you hear the question, or I need to repeat it?
I did not. I'm sorry. Go ahead. What was
okay,
your question?
Well, here we go. Here's the question. Did you hear about me going from learning how
you're
to
listening.
Shoot as a shooter myself?
Yes, sir. I certainly did.
Very good. So most people don't go through what I went through to learn to become a shooter and be lucky enough to be around someone who is like an ex-Ranger. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the person who's listening to the show right now, and they've seen all the new tactical information that's out on the web. They maybe have gone to a couple seminars, and they decided they want to get involved with firearms. What would you tell that person who's never picked up a firearm? What would be the first thing that you would share with them what they need to do?
I share with them four things that they need to do. Crush grip on the gun, center line the gun like we do with Wing Chun, shoulders, pelvis, lean forward. Don't aim as in target shooting with the front sight, rear sight, point index, which is what the SAS taught me, and squeeze the trigger and stay on target.
We jump the gun. Listen, sir, we jump the gun a little bit. I don't want to go that far yet. I want to go to the beginning. Like I met you, say, for the first time at the Super Show or an event,
mm-hmm.
and I understand who you are. And I say, sir, mm-hmm. I'm interested in learning how to use a firearm. What should I do first to be able to purchase a firearm or go get a firearm or even just look at a firearm? I'm talking about the novice person who has no idea how to handle a gun. What would you tell them? That's the question I wanted to ask you.
Okay, again, the same thing. Get a gun that's comfortable for you to shoot. I recommend 9mm. I start everybody off that's even never shot a gun and do those four principles. Crush grip on the gun, finger out of the trigger. Point the gun in the direction that it needs to be fired. Lean your pelvis and shoulders forward. Have your arms extended, squeeze the trigger, and shoot at the target as if it was a human silhouette. And I do that left-handed, right-handed, and rapid fire in less than 5 to 3 minutes. And I'm getting them comfortable because that's what shooting a gun, handgun, is all about, is shooting with confidence. And once they're safely doing that in confidence, then we can make the holes that are in the target group smaller. It's that simple. Shooting same bullets in the same hole all the time is cool in a handgun shooting for one thing, and that's chicks dig it. And other than that, it serves no purpose. As long as you can hit the person center mass at 10 to 20 feet away, which they can with center line shooting, it's right there. I did it four times today on the range with people that never shot.
Answer my question. You need to get a gun that's comfortable, okay, in your hand.
Absolutely.
Correct? Now, the different, as they say, the terminology kick comes in different firearms. A 22 is not going to kick like a 9mm or so on. So isn't it important that that person ask these questions before they, just because the gun feels good in their hand, they need to ask the expert how much of a jolt that gun's going to have before they buy it, or is that important?
Well, recoil is very important to manage. If you look at the law enforcement studies, they went from, after the FBI shootout, they went from 9mm to 10mm, then they cropped it down to 40, and they still couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. So they went back to 9mm because of the improvements in technologies in the 9mm round, and they are satisfied with that now, that it's a good defensive round to use, and that's the one that I use to tell all people basic, whether they're old, young, short, big, strong. 9mm is excellent to control recoil, and it's a good defensive round. So that's what I use.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. A lot of people like for women, they say, well, you should start out with a 22. I find that very insulting. In fact, I would never do that around Graciela Casillas and any of her crew or any of the women that were at the museum event and belittle them that well, like, okay, dear, we don't think you can handle the recoil of a really big gun, so we're going to give you a mouse gun. I would never do that to them because I fear for my life, and I just won't disrespect women that way. So get them up and running, shooting right out of the gate with a 9mm. Everybody can do that. Everybody can handle it, no problem.
Not a question, but just something that I would share with you. A lot of the guys that I talk to, and even some of the women, they like a backup gun. So you recommend, say, a 9mm, learn to shoot with a 9mm, and maybe have like a 32 or, you know, something smaller as a backup gun? Or do you believe in a backup gun?
I do for certain given purposes. Usually law enforcement officers need a backup gun because most law enforcement officers can't hit the broadside of a barn, and they want to go with the mythology that they actually are good shots because that's what television and Hollywood show. But the reality is they hit one out of every three shots that they're firing in a gunfight. So they are expending all their magazine and their bullets. So they need a backup gun because they haven't hit anything, for goodness sakes. But you take somebody like the Wolverine, who's well-trained in all lethal arts, when that man points that gun at somebody, I guarantee you that person is getting shot. So the backup gun that I carry every day is not me worrying about a gunfight, me not hitting my target. It might be, say, you come and visit me and you don't have your concealed carry permit in Florida and we get in a jam, I can give you my gun is a secondary gun that I have in case I need warriors to grab a gun and back me up in a self-defense situation. So that is the reason why I carry a backup gun, not so much as I've run out of bullets and, you know, or it's an apocalypse, because if it's an apocalypse, we should be having a rifle and our secondary gun should be a handgun. That's just how I look at it.
So let me ask you a question about concealed. How long has Florida allowed that?
Almost 20 years. We started with the Make My Day law back in the 80s, and then it went to Stand Your Ground. So we've been one of the forefront runners in the country for shall issue for concealed carry.
So how do you feel about when they have open carry, like they just allowed in Texas this past year, like if you do in Arizona?
There's a lot of people in my crowd that are very much against open carry. I'm pretty much for it because I think if you're trained and if you know what you're doing with it and you're confident with that firearm, then I don't think a whole lot of people are going to try to take it away from you, as has been documented. So, because I'm such a big fan of Master Piles and his presence as a Wolverine, I would defy anyone to try to take that man's firearm away from him when he's open carrying anywhere. Good luck with that.
Well, listen to me. You're making his head real big. I know you are. He's listening right now. And you talk about him like you like that. So I got to calm him down. for this segment. So don't be talking about Wolverine like he's the greatest guy on
earth
anymore.
Hey,
okay?
Hey, Professor, let him
stay
let
now.
Him
I don't want you're not on the air yet, Wolverine. You're not on the air yet. So don't, just hold your peace. Hold your peace.
Okay.
Now, Paul, let me ask you another question on the novice level. On the novice level, you know, you said some of your guys are against open carry, but here's the problem I see. I see it now. I saw it 10, 15 years ago. You know, I've seen it a long time. People just don't go to the range enough. As I said earlier in my segment, they don't practice enough and they don't rejuvenate their knowledge enough by getting around someone like you every now and then. And that's what the problem of it is. I think people think they can just buy a gun, buy some ammunition, go through the firing range once or twice, and then they can get a concealed license, and that's the bad part. How do you feel
about
that?
And that's the absolute gospel. You're preaching the gospel on that, sir. There's no doubt about it. That is akin to back in the day in Japan when people were open carrying a samurai sword. Well, if they didn't train with it like a samurai did, and they're just carrying it off, well, you're going to be on the chopping block when you reach and meet a real samurai that knows what he's doing with that sword. So absolutely correct. Going to
well,
the range is everything.
You know, I did some research before I wanted to get you on the air, and I'm going to just kind of walk you down a little bit and tell me if I'm wrong or right, and stop me, please, if you feel I'm wrong. You know, think about when guns – let's just talk about early 1700s, when guns were used for eating and hunting and for protection and so forth. But yet they were simple, single shots. You know, it wasn't the anything like a multi – like the Western days. And then, of course, let's talk about the Western guys, the gunslingers who lived and died by the gun, per se. Well, through the ages, through the decades, gun handlers have changed so much. And it's changed so much where everybody thinks now because of video games, because of what the public teaches, because of YouTube, that anybody can buy a gun, get a gun, shoot that gun, and just be accurate with it. And I like the fact, I really want to emphasize the fact about dry firing, like the firing they do with targets, electronic targets, which I think is really cool. Going to the range and practicing with someone like yourself, at least, if you're gonna carry a gun, you need to go with someone who at least once a month, just to get rejuvenated. Because every time you pick up that gun and it's loaded, it's a different scenario. I know that. But a lot of people don't know that. They don't understand that. How can we educate people more about the education of guns? Is it what's the secret of educating?
Well, it's like the gospel of Christ. You can lead people to water, but you can't make them drink. And it's kind of akin to people can watch YouTube videos all day long on Jet King Doe or Goju Ryu or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but
they're not going to be able to do it unless they go
out and get a black belt unless you get a teacher. So you got to have a teacher to show you that stuff. So that's where it all boils down to. It's the reality versus.
Okay, so we've talked about the training a little bit, the procedures to do that. And we know you're an expert in that, but now I'm going to hit you with something that's in the headlines, and that's the gun violence that's going on in America. How does Paul Pawalla, who's experienced training, tactical, and also life and death situations, how do you feel about the gun violence that's going on in America today? And I'm not talking about the shootings or anything. I'm just talking about gun violence in general.
Well, I think that's we've lost a value for life in this country, and there's no moral respect on anything. There's no moral authority, and people and it all started with in the 60s with Roe versus Wade and the abortion thing. And when you just don't have a life for the most precious thing in the world, like a child, then what makes us think we're any going to respect any man's laws? And that's what you have is just about utter chaos, people that are not being responsible citizens and doing unresponsible things. whether it be accidental discharges or whether it be self-inflicted gunshot wounds or outright premeditated murder. There's just no more. Our moral compass is way off in this country, and I don't know if we could stick the finger into the leaking dike and plug it back up, because I think that's almost a foregone conclusion.
Is there ever going to be a time when you feel the government will come in and say, we want to take all your guns? You're not going to be allowed to do that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've got a story to tell you. I was digging deep a couple of years ago, and do you realize how many Texans have bunkers in the middle of Texas, and those are armories full of ammunition and guns? Look, I mean, Texans. They say that Texans have more guns in those armories underneath the ground than some of the police and some of the – I mean, it's amazing, Texans' mentality about guns. Did you know that? Did you even realize that?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't realize that until a couple years ago. It just blows me away to know that the mentality – and it's not just Texas, I'm sure. There's other parts of the country. But you believe that someday the government's going to come in and say, we want all your guns that you have in your home?
Yes. Well, it's already happening right now. New Jersey's just starting. There's a couple other small pockets that are doing it. But as a Christian, if we believe in the Bible, that is the word of God, and it talks in Revelations about a new world order, one world government, a one world bank and a one world leader, then something has to fall in the United States. And because we're the last baton of freedom in the world. And Ronald Reagan said it succinctly back in the day, if America falls, so does freedom in the entire world. And if that book is 100% accurate, like I know it is, then yes, we are going to lose our freedoms. So if you look at the 45% on the last Gallup poll said our youth absolutely thinks communism is the way to go as far as how things should be done in leadership. And my thing is, let's ship every one of these people that are in college to live in a communist country and see the reality of what that really is, because they have no idea what they're talking about.
Amen. Amen. Well, before I take my break, I just want to say personally, thank you for your service. Thank you for who you are and all the people that you've influenced. The time spending with you on the radio is very precious to me. And when we come back, we're going to play the Legends Name Game. We'll talk about the power of women a little bit and the amazing article you wrote for Black Belt Magazine and MA Success. And we're going to talk about a little bit of future things that we're going to do with the museum. So will you stay tuned, Paul, and I'm going to bring you up,
sir,
in just a few minutes.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
God bless you, buddy. I'm standing and talking with Paul Pawalo from Warrior Magazine. Literally has written over 100 articles and over 25 published magazines, but an expert in firearms and tactical expertise and operational gear. So we'll bring him on back in a few minutes, but what a great, great interview this is being. Well, you know, this is one of my favorite segments now. I never thought I'd have a favorite segment, but I do have a favorite one, and it's always interesting, the subjects and the topics that I talk with this young man. He is a young man, even though he's almost turning 50. But in my heart, he's young because he's younger than me. One of the great, great competitors of 2018 and presently. I'm talking about Kicking with the Wolverine, Mr. Dean Pyles. Hey, Dean, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Well, how are you? Merry Christmas.
Doing good. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Well, good. You know, we're going to be take a two-week break here. Hachi Bowen, by the grace of his ability to produce, he's allowed me to get 2 weeks off where I don't get to scream at you or scream at anybody or talk karate stuff. So I don't know. So.
I know you'll call me and scream at me anyway. So, it may not be on the radio, but I'll still,
Well, we're going to have two great shows. We're going to do the Ricky Smith and Randy Smith show that we did, and we're going to do the Thanksgiving show for New Year's. So But we'll be back a week later, and we'll have fun. Our tonight's topic is an interesting topic that we talked about, but here it is kind of in a nutshell. You know, when karate first came to America, it wasn't made for competition. It was made for self-defense and learning and art that was produced by people who had hung out in Okinawa and Japan and Korea. They came to America, and they did karate do. Well, sooner or later, there were promoters, and that's what they are in America, producers, and not naming names, but the early producers decided they should have a competition. And that competition in America would be two black belts, and they allowed some brown belts to compete in these tournaments. No kata in the beginning, and they would fight for 2 points. 1 point for Ippon. They didn't get the half points then. They gave 1 point for Ippon, and then they give another point, a full point, maybe 2 points. And if you got 2 points on your opponent, you won the fight. Now, you pay a small entry fee. I think the original entry fees were like $10, and they'd have these trophies. They didn't give out medals or plaques or anything. They give out little trophies, and you won a trophy. Well, sooner or later, they decided, well, we got to separate these people from the lightweight to the heavyweight. And so lightweight start already fighting, and I think the cutoff was 160 below, and anything above 160 was a heavyweight. Well, they weren't happy there. They needed to throw in the middleweights, and the middleweights was thrown in. So now the heavyweights started at like 170. Middleweights was 145 to say 160, and 145 below was a lightweight. Well, they weren't happy there. They decided to make, you know, basically they created kickboxing, and kickboxing guys didn't want to ever think about fighting a heavyweight if they were a lightweight. So they developed the division, super lightweight, lightweight, super middleweight, middleweight, light heavyweight, light middle, oh, just went on and on and on, all the way up to super heavyweight. So now you had all these divisions for doing competition and deciding who was the best in that particular division. They had thrown out the whole beginning concept that was to show self-defense or to show control and kimi and all the neat things that you learn in karate do. And they turned it into a pure, I guess you can say, competition. And the competition grew and grew and grew. And, of course, it's turned out to be a multi-million dollar sport. But what does a competitor get out of competing? What is the real reason someone decides whether they're a white belt beginner or a seasoned black belt to get out there and lay it on the line to show their ability and technique? It's changed so much. Of course, now it's about winning so-called world championships. And it was about national championships. And, of course, like this weekend, they're doing a state championship and all these different championships. But how many championships can you win to set, well, to prove what you decided to do in the beginning? I can only talk about myself. The only reason I competed in the early years was that I wanted to see if what I had learned was real enough to stop somebody who was trained as hard as I had or maybe better than me. And even if I didn't win so-called a fight, 3-0 or whatever it was back then, 5-0, 3-0, then it still showed me that some of my techniques would work. I also thought that my students that would watch me fight, then they would say, hey, my instructor, he knows what he's doing. He can really defend himself against somebody that knows what they're doing. Well, I got news for them. A street fighter is the most dangerous person in the world. A street fighter would do anything to win. It doesn't matter about guns or knives or baseball bats or glass bottles or anything or fists or kicks. A street fighter would do anything. And in the beginning, karate started out with learning how to defend against that street fighter, and it turned into a game of tag. But why do people compete? Do they compete for the trophies? They compete for the awards, the glory? I don't think they compete anymore to really show that they can really defend themselves. Maybe they do. Tell me, Wolverine, why do you think people compete today in 2018?
Well, you know, a lot of it is ego, obviously. And then nowadays with competition, you know, a lot of your movie stars are coming out of the competition circuit. You know, they look for them, pick them, and then they also, you know, Hollywood watches the trick.
But you can't really say that someone goes to competition to think that they're going to be picked up by a Hollywood producer. I mean, come
on.
They might have done that in the early.
Some people do. I mean, you know, but, you know, my take is on it. You know, I want to go to make sure that I'm continuously keeping my skills sharp. And, you know, if it's done right and the competitions are done right and they're judged right, then, you know, people get a lot out of it. If it's not, then they don't get anything.
What did you get out of it? Was karate even made for competition? No. So
no,
what did they get out of it?
But
so what did
they
get out
like
of
Bruce
it besides?
Well, for one, it gives them a goal, something to do. Because a lot of people get burnt out just doing their martial arts. I mean, you can't run out and fight on the street all the time. And, you know, being in the combatives world, I know a lot of people say that the most dangerous fighters in the world are street fighters. But I know for a fact that you can take a street fighter's heart very, very quickly if you've got any kind of skills. They will do things that are unpredictable, but it's shame on the martial artist if he's not trained in unpredictability and being ready to encounter something that they normally wouldn't. And shame on them if they're not willing to take that extra step. But competition does one thing. It helps people to set goals, start training, so they get a regiment, so now they're healthier, they're living more of an athletic lifestyle, so they're able to elevate themselves. And if they're being judged right and the people that are competing against them, because there are a lot of super, super talented competitors, then it helps each person, like we say, as steel sharpens steel, we sharpen each other. It makes you have to go, man, I got to work on my technique, sharpen it up. Although, you know, modern day has drifted away from what it originally was to see if technique worked. It's more of a game of speed and accuracy, but speed and accuracy can also be used, if you use it properly, to train athletes. So when I take my guys to competition and I have them working on their footwork, their speed, their accuracy, creating angles, evasion, not getting hit. Well, if you apply those into a real fight and you add power and solid technique to do damage, then you've got an even more dangerous fight. And that's why a lot of these
question.
Guys...
Let me ask you a question. Wolverine, let me ask you a question. Say you go to a competition and you, whatever weight division it is, and they line up. Well, they don't even line up people anymore. That's an old art. They just do everything by computer. But in the back in the day, they'd line people up. And you could literally see all the fighters that were you were going to fight. Okay? It was competitive. And there was crazy people who do crazy things. One of the things that I would do is I'd line up first. And I realized that the person that would line up next to me either wanted to beat the crap out of me, knock me off a pedestal, or just say they wanted to beat me. Or sometimes they maybe didn't like me. What I would do, in 5 minutes, I'd move. I'd go to the other part of the line, or I'd go to the middle. And then I'd watch that person next to me, how they would react. Some people would say, I don't want to fight you first, Mr. Lee. Why'd you move over here? Well, I'd watch how their body would work, how they'd talk to me. Well, guess what, Wolverine? I'd move again. I know that was outrageous, and people don't do that. But that was the way I competed because I wanted to mess with everybody's mind before I stepped in the ring, whoever I fought, whether I beat them or not. To me, it was a mental game.
It's a strategy.
Understand why people compete just for a trophy. To me, competition was playing the whole game and not just half the game. And I missed that lineup. I missed those famous words, line up. I mean, that's a raw start. They don't do that anymore.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, so. And you had a good strategy. I mean, that's a good strategy. But, you know, strategy is the art of the warrior. But, you know, you can even apply strategy in modern-day sport karate if that's what, you know, if that competitor does it. I always have a strategy when I go to competition. You know that. We talk about it. I make sure my students, we have a strategy. You know, so – you know, it can be taught, and it's a good field to do that because they can do it without having to worry about getting hurt, because, like I say, you just can't run around fighting all the time. So, you know, you can join the military and go into combat, and people find out that it's not as glamorous. And I try to tell people all the time, they want a slow build up. You know, like in class, people come in and they're like, "Man, y'all really going at it. This is my first night." And I'm like, you know, on a street fight, there's not a slow build up. In the military, when you go in and you go into combat, they don't start out shooting rubber bullets and beanbags at you, kill you from day one. So when you start training, you have to start training hardcore from day one. You know, you can't have this slow build up. You got to train it like you're going
to
do.
One of my friends that did a couple of tours, he'd always say, it's not how many people that you kill. It's learning how not to be killed. Learning how to, yeah. So, you know, with that said, thank you so much for the insight on the service part. And I know you're enjoying the show tonight with Paul, but thank you for your vision of competition. You know, it's one of those subjects that I always wonder why people really compete on a black belt level. But I know why people compete below black belt, you know, because about goals and that type of thing and rewards. But black belt level,
right.
I don't think there's too many people think like a lot of the old warriors fought back in the day, you know. And I remember one of the things I used to teach you, I still do, is that when you step into the ring, you own it. It's going to take someone very special to take that ring, that competition area from you. And that's one of the things I really wanted to pass on to you. But thank you so much for tonight, Dean. You have a Merry Christmas.
And, you too. And
we're going
to
do a recap next week.
And go ahead.
No, I was going to say we're going to do a recap next week, and I think I'm going to ask you to be my co-host if you're not doing anything. It'll be the week before Christmas. Yeah.
You know, I'm always available for you.
Cool. Well, then we might plan to do that. So everybody's listening. You're going to hear the Wolverine and Professor Lee have fun recapping the year and some of the neat things that happened, and we'll touch on some of the amazing things that happened too. So thank you, Dean Piles. Thank you, Wolverine, for your time tonight.
Thank you.
And as always,
well,
I love you.
Y'all are awesome.
Well, thank you so much. God bless you. Well, that's the Wolverine, everybody. Dean Piles, as you know him, and you know, one of the best competitors we got in the open circuit today. I think he walked out with quite a few world championships this year with NASCA. Hey, well, coming back to my special guest tonight, Paul Pawalla, and what a great, great interview this has been. We covered some subjects, and we've got to talk about guns and gun control and violence and all the cool things. But now we're going to change venue a little bit, and we're going to play the Legends Name Game and also talk about something that happened in September that he just wrote about, an incredible 5-page article that he's going to submit to Black Belt Magazine and Make Success. And I want to talk about that a little bit. Paul, you there, buddy?
Yes, sir.
Again, the article was incredible, but you had some influence. You're a big fan of my instructor. One of my instructors was Mr. J. Pat Burleson and George Vinci, but one of my instructors who I love dearly and you know is Jim Harrison. And when we first met at the Universal Marxist Hall of Fame, I was overwhelmed at how much love and passion you showed for Jim Harrison and the inspiration you had to be a part of what I do. Tell me your experience besides asking your lovely soon-to-be wife, Linda, to be married. But tell me about some of the experience you experienced at the Living Legends this year with the incredible 100 women that I put together for that event.
Oh my goodness, where would I start? I guess I'll go in reverse order and talk about, well, first of all, I can't say what an honor too much it was to meet Mickey Roe Moore. She is such an iconic legend.
If you say Mickey, next time she sees you, she'll kick you in the groin.
Mikey. Yeah. Mikey, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Now she'll probably kick my butt because of it. But Mikey has been a, you know, I think she's kind of the equivalent of a Joe Louis or Bill Wallace of her time. There's no doubt about it. she was such a huge competitor and inspiration. So that was an overwhelming person to meet and talk to. I just can't tell you what an honor that was. And then there was, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right, Vicky Morrow.
Yes.
I was at.
From North Carolina.
I'm sorry?
She's from North Carolina, yes.
Yeah. I was at the Battle of Atlanta that she took, that she won back in the day.
Really? So,
yeah.
Cool.
We talked about that a little bit. And, you know, again, she knew a trainer that I trained with in North Carolina, in John Lamont, who had it, at the time he was very well hailed as an Aikido guy, but had a falling out in the legal realm, which I won't go into. But we shared that and talked about that, and it was she was amazed that I was at the Battle of Atlanta that she was when she won it. But
and then there's some incredible women. But we had, like I said, we had almost close to 100 black belt women there.
Yeah,
and
crazy.
There were all ages from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000. We had young ones, we had old ones. But
yep.
To me, I've got to say something really, really special about the event that you wrote about. You particularly wrote about my partner, my student, Darlene McPherson Pagels. What people don't realize, she was going to be testing for her eighth Dan, and she was doing bunkai with my son Garrett and also performing. Well, right before she was supposed to be on the floor, I had one of my black belts, and I was talking about how you act in bullring, how it's a, it's technique, but it's also a little bit of acting. And so when I touched him, he fell, and that was part of the acting part, but guess who he fell on? He fell on Darlene's leg, and her leg went backwards. Now, this
yeah,
was
right there.
10 minutes. Yes. It was 10
yep.
minutes before she was supposed to go on and perform and then do bunkai with my son, who most of you guys know, he's a pure animal. And even though, he loves Darlene, he's still, he's Garrett Lee. He does everything really hard. So I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, what have I done? And it was really my fault because my black belt just reacted to what I was doing. Well, Darlene goes out there, not only running the women's symposium, not only being my backup for everything I do. And she goes out there and performs her kata and then does the bunkai with Garrett flawlessly. I was so amazed and that was the type of character that a lot of those women portrayed. I've got to mention one more woman. I've got to mention her. And that was a dear friend of Vicky Morrow's. Her name is Marty McDonald. And Marty is the widow of Bill McDonald, who was part of the Sika organization back in the 70s and 80s in the Carolinas. And we just lost Bill, who's one of my history generals. But she came and she read a beautiful letter from the concept of a woman speaking about black belt and her position as being someone who's beside one of the greats. So these are just a couple of people that really were amazing for this event. But you got to capture it. And we've got it on Facebook, the whole story. It'll be in Black Belt Magazine and also MA Success. And it's really well done. And I just can't thank you enough for what you did. Thank you.
Well, it was an honor. And now that I'm thinking about it, I feel bad that I did not mention Master McDonald's letter.
Marty.
Because that – everybody choked
it
up
was
on
very
that
good.
One. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was,
and I owe her a big apology. And I might sneak in a rewrite on that a little bit for that purpose.
Oh,
but,
it's okay. You're the best at that. Now, let me ask you a question. The influence that happened, that something very special happened that night at the end of the event. You asked someone very special to do something very special. What was exactly was that? Tell me. Tell my listeners what you did.
Well, I've always been thinking about my partner that I've been with for 7 years, and it was our anniversary that was there, and I said, you know, it is time to do something right in this relationship. And I thought, what a great opportunity, because I didn't tell anybody I was going to do it, but I proposed to my very best friend and partner, Linda Kiesling, and I got down on one knee after I was talking, after you had me talk about her, and I said, well, she's not my wife, and I need to correct that right now. So then I proposed to her at your event, sir.
I'm telling you, everybody was just, there were tears everywhere. You made everybody feel really, really good.
Yeah, including my fiance, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, this year you also were inducted officially as a history general for the Museum of Sport Karate and the work that I've been doing for 20 years. And your responsibility for that is to help bring more covert and more tactical guys who are martial artists in the frame of the things that I'm doing. But before we talk about some of those guys that you're going to be bringing in next year, there's a particular samurai, and I feel in his heart he's probably a samurai reincarnated, but he has something very special. He is in the Guinness Book of World Records, and we're going to be trying to bring him in next year, or at least honor him. We will honor him next year. Tell me a little about your friend, who he is, and what he has to offer, and his wife.
Chuck Helmke and his partner are Guinness Book of World Record holders for the most tattooed, being the most tattooed elderly people in the world. They hold that Guinness Book of World Record feat. They are the most tattooed people in the world. But Chuck Helmke,
but their tattoos
also
tell a story, particularly. Tell me about their tattoos. Tell them about that. That's the best part.
Chuck Helmke's whole body tells a story of samurai. In fact, when he was in Japan, he was at a show over there doing a tattoo show, and the Japanese thought he was, is it Yakuza? Or Yakuza, I think the word is for
Yakuza.
You know, for their,
yeah,
Yakuza.
Some people say Yakuza
who
don't know how to say it, and the actual word is Yakuza. Yes, sir.
Yakuza, yeah. So, but his body actually tells the journey of a samurai from start to finish, and it's amazing artwork. It just really is. And he's a martial artist. He studied in Korea. And he's kind of a mentor of mine. He's one of the most philosophical men I've ever met. And his wife, partner, I should say, I'm sorry, she just started the whole thing, and her artwork tells many stories on her body as well. So it's kind of amazing people.
Yes, I was very fascinated by looking at what you sent me. And they're just one of the few people that you're going to help me get involved with. Now, tell me some of the military guys that you're thinking about bringing in next year as an ambassador and get them involved with what I'm doing.
Well, there's three of them that I would very much like to honor because they're mentors of mine, and they're all very, very high in the military as far as martial artists. You have Gary O'Neill, who I talked about, that lived with Michael and Janice. They lived together. Michael and Janice was on Gary's fire team as a ranger in Vietnam. And so Gary O'Neill basically wrote the Special Forces hand-to-hand combat manual. And his forte was, his specialty was sensory removal, which he wrote the book on because he did it for real, and he's considered high up there. In fact, he was with Operation Blue Light while Delta Force was getting componently ready. So a lot of stuff that Delta Force uses to this day was based on Gary O'Neill, and he was the co-founder of the Special Forces SEER School, Survival, Escape, Resist, and Evade. So he's a giant and a legend.
That's exciting.
In the Special
That's
Forces
exciting.
Community.
Yes. Yes.
Then you have Max Mullen, who was a Ranger in three different Ranger battalions, retired as a Ranger. He co-wrote the Hand-to-Hand Combatives Manual for the entire military. So he is the author of the Hand-to-Hand Combatives Manual when he was in the military
wow.
and teaching Ranger combatives. And then the last guy is a man I'm very, very proud of. He was with Delta Force for over 10 years. He was the youngest man ever to be selected to the Delta Force selection and made it his first time around at 23 years old. And he was Delta Force's hand-to-hand combatives instructor, and he was the Delta Force breacher on the Operation Acid Gambit in Panama, that was Delta Force's first successful hostage rescue with Kurt Muse. Then he went on.
Well, incredible.
Yeah. Then he went on to work for the CIA for quite a few years. So those are
wow,
the guys I'm bringing to the museum.
Wow, that's really cool. And you know, Colonel Phil Torres and of course Mr. Piles, they're my mentors, and every year that I honor the armed forces and the people. But you know, I would like to do something because, you know, I do everything on the spirit of what I'm told by a higher power. And you know, I remember as a kid reading about Mr. Achanis in Black Belt magazine, and then when he died in a helicopter crash, I remember reading that article too. And then to have the lineage of Mr. O'Neill and then you follow in his lineage, I would be very honored with the three gentlemen that are going in, but also to give Mr. O'Neill maybe something as a memorial Dragon Image Fighting Award in Mr. Chanis's name, so he can always remember the fact that the martial arts played a very important part, and the lineage is still there. And to be able to talk about him 20, 30 years later, and the people that did read Black Belt 20, 30 years ago, they remember him and how important he was and what he did, and how tragic it was when we lost him in that helicopter crash. So if you allow me, and with Mr. O'Neill's permission, and with your permission, I would love to do that this year at the event.
I think that would absolutely be outstanding and amazing. I mean, Gary O'Neill was inspirational to many, many warriors. He was a right-hand man to Colonel Bob Howard, who was put in for three, not one, but three Medal of Honors. He actually was awarded one,
wow.
but they didn't want to give him two more because they didn't want him. That would have made him the most highest decorated man in military history, and the politicians wouldn't do that. But his peers all say he should have got every one of those medals because he was just a phenomenal.
It would be really cool if somehow or another we can get him there, and Colonel Torres and Mr. Piles and yourself can personally give that to him for Michael Achanis and for himself. That'd be really cool. But we'll work on it. That's one of the things we can work on this year. You know, I got to share with you something because you bring back a lot of memories for me, even though I've never been in the military. I've always been around the military, and I'm very close to a lot of people in the military as we speak. But you know, my first encounter in any type of tactical situation, especially meeting people from Rangers or even Delta Force, it all started in a karate tournament in Ohio, and I was approached by a man named Dr. Man G. And Dr. Man G is actually the godfather to my son, Garrett Lee, and a lot of it has to do with this encounter. He saw me do a knife demonstration for this tournament, and he approached me, and he said he had a gathering, that's what he called it, a gathering in Savannah, Georgia, and he would like me to come down and maybe demonstrate some of the things that I did in the knife demo. I had no idea who Dr. Man G is. You know, he's the founder of Bando, and just an amazing, amazing person. Was the first PKA center referee for the PKA. So I go to Savannah, Georgia. I think it was the second time I've ever been on a plane. he took care of everything, my airfare, everything. And I get off the plane, and I get picked up by a Jeep, and it's a brother. And, you know, I'm completely trusting whoever this guy is because he had my name and everything. And I'm young, you know, I'm still in my teens. And so I get in the Jeep, and I'm being friendly as I could be. And we go through Savannah, we go over the bridge. And if you've been to Savannah, Georgia, you know, after the bridge, it kind of turns into the marshland. And he's going toward, at that time, I didn't know, the fort that's out there in Savannah. And he keeps driving, and I see civilization in my rear, and I'm thinking, what have I done? Am I going to be killed? I mean, what have I done? I have no idea what's going on here. And I'll be honest with you, I was scared. I was real scared when he took a right down a dirt road. You know? I was really nerve-wracking. But then I saw it in the distance, and it was like, oh, maybe 50 tents and a clearing and like an open field. And then I saw the swamps, and then I saw the guys, and they were all different types. They were, you know, I found out they were Rangers, they were Delta, you know, they were Green Beret. They were all kinds of people. And I got out of that Jeep, and Dr. G met me, and the first thing he said to me, I'll never forget, he says, don't be nervous, just do what you did and get their respect. Well, I was nervous, and I had no idea about who I was in front of. And it was my first encounter with the type of men that are real true warriors in the military. And I saw these guys doing the baton. I don't even know the terminology for the – you know the baton that has the two – thick ends on the end. What's
yeah,
it called?
Pugel stick.
Pugel sticks. That's what they are. That's what they are. Exactly.
Yes,
pugel sticks. I saw the guys doing that, and I walked up to Dr. G. And I said, Dr. G, maybe if I show some of my skills before I do the knife, maybe I can get some respect. And he says, well, do what you feel comfortable in doing. Because he believed in me, which is really cool. So the first thing they did was, as you know, about pugel sticks, they get you in positions where you really can't get out of. And the first one they did was a full Nelson behind my neck. And they basically said I had 15 seconds to get out of. Well, I reacted. I stomped one of the guy's foot when he let go a little bit. I hit the guy in the groin. He let go enough. I wrapped it around, hit the other guy in the face. It was over. The second time they did it between my legs, and if you remember that one, that's a hard one, okay? It's hard to get out of when they do it between your legs. Well, all I did was roll over, Paul. I rolled over, took a hammerfish strike, hit that guy in the foot really hard, made him let go, kicked the guy in the groin, and I was out of it. From that moment, it led up to the moment where I could do my knife stuff. And I'm by no means, you know, but I'm pretty fast with my hands, and I was doing some really good technical stuff. But that was my first introduction into that type of group of men. And I fell in love with you guys. You know, the neat thing about real warriors, whether they're martial arts or they're military, they're true to themselves. They're loyal. And it's all about taking care of that next guy, you know, and always never leaving nobody behind. Nobody. No matter how tough it is. No matter what the circumstances. And I realized what loyalty was through that group that I went to. So you probably heard of those secret camps, huh? Have you ever been to a few?
I've been to one or two, yes, sir.
They're interesting because you get all different makes and models in that camp, and they come there for a reason, just to become better, kind of like what we talked about tonight in the early interview. The more you practice with your firearm, with your weapon, the more proficient you're going to be. Now, let me ask you a question. How important is it for you to be a history general in your career now? And you've accomplished so much. You know, you don't need this, but you took it with open arms, and you're so enthusiastic. But I wanted to ask you and tell my listeners how important it is to be a history general for the Museum of Sport Karate.
Well, it's interesting because I've been in the martial arts and been around so many great people all of my life that there's things that I can contribute to people in the karate museum that things that they don't know. Like, I'll give you one thing that you and I share that I haven't told you yet. I so admire your grandmaster that promoted you to ninth degree. I've never met him, but he's always been, yes, sir, Grandmaster Harrison. He's always been, I've always admired him from day one that I've ever read about him. But we share a commonality in Grandmaster Harrison, because his good friend as a police officer was Jim Morrell, or Jim Liddell, rather. And
yes.
Jim Liddell certified me, was one of the first guys that certified me as a national police handgun retention instructor. And they're good friends.
Wow.
How about that?
That's good. That's a circle of life. Absolutely. And that's very special. I'll have to tell that to him next time I talk to him before Christmas. Well, you know, this has been very, very informational for people who I'm sure tuned in and listened and listen on the podcast. If someone wanted to Paul Pawala for a seminar to get in contact with you, how would they reach you and tell them how to get in touch with you?
Well, my website is assaultcountertactics.com. And if anybody just wants to Google me, my name will come up, and so will my website. And all my information is on there, my phone number, my email addresses, because I have no life, really. So everything's out in the public open. You know, so there it is. And anytime anybody wants to train with me, for the people that are involved in the karate museum, I have a policy that I don't charge any money at all to family. That means friends. All my friends are family, and the people at the karate museum are family to me. So if they ever wanted to do any training with me, I'm never going to charge them a dime.
Well, we got a couple things coming up this year. Of course, you'll be at my event at the Hawaiian Roast and doing a seminar. But we have something coming up July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Las Vegas, and you're actually bringing my special guest, be part of the booth. But you're bringing someone very special, and I want to talk about him for a moment. He's the owner of one of the tactical companies in America. Tell me a little bit about your partner that you're bringing to the Super Show this year.
Mark Joseph is the CEO of Spartan Training Gear, which is a upgrade from Tony Blauer's spear gear. And in law enforcement community, it's the only gear recognized for the entire world for both simmunitions and for UTM training rounds to use both in defensive tactics scenarios and law enforcement. I got a lot of flack for endorsing because I've tested that gear for 5 years and put in writing that is best tactical gear in the world. And a lot of people poo-pooed it and laughed at me. And then what happened is every training gear out there that was using UTM or simmunitions had their licenses revoked and for using it for tactical use. And the only one authorized right now is Spartan Gear, and those guys, when they do seminars, they get into the Spartan Gear and they say, bring your karate to them and let's see if it works. And they go full force and just beat the living snot out of you. Because Mark Joseph has been in the martial arts and karate for years as well, so he knows all the moves. And it's endorsed by a lot of MMA fighters like great Shannon Rich, who's a 9-time world champion, who's, by the way, I need to plug Shannon real quick. He's going to be on HBO, an HBO special up and coming on his whole lifestyle in the MMA and the martial arts. And I was a part of that that I'm going to be a part of that special. So I'm very proud of that.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to and helping Mark Joseph get his name out there with the Super Show, which is the largest martial art industry show in the world. And I've already called Mike, Mr. Dillard, and told him that you guys are coming as my guests. So we're going to be sharing the Super Show together July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Las Vegas at the Bellagio. And if you're out there, make sure you come by and see our booth. Meet Mark and meet Paul Pawala. And also my great special guest, Jim Buten, who's always there every year with me at the Sport Karate Museum. Well, that's our show for tonight. Thank you, Paul, for being on the air. Thank you, Wolverine. I want you guys to have a very Merry Christmas. And you'll be able to listen to this on podcast here in a little bit. We'll be putting it on the media. And, Paul, tell your lovely wife and your partner Merry Christmas also. And I sure appreciate you taking time and spending time with the old Hawaii boy tonight. It means a lot to me. It means a lot.
Yep.
Well,
Merry
I want to
wish you, you guys.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Master Paul. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just saying Merry Christmas to both you guys. And Paul, it was awesome interview. Loved every minute of it.
Well, I admire both of you men like nobody's business. I endorse you men like nobody's business. I love you all very much, and everybody that's part of the Karate Museum, you guys are family. All of you are family, and I'm so humbled to be just a minor part of it and do whatever I can for it. It's just an honor. Like it's a shock and awe honor to me to be part of it.
Well, we
appreciate you so much. We really thank you for all you do.
Thank you so much for your service, and thank you for your time tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, you are going to be here next week with a wrap-up of this year, and I believe the Wolverine's going to be my co-host. We're going to plan on that. And then Christmas night, we'll be on the air, but it'll be a rerun of the Ricky Smith and Randy Smith interview, which was the top-rated show that we did this year. And then New Year's Eve, or New Year's, we'll be doing the Thanksgiving show, where we pay thankful thanks to everybody that has contributed to the Sport Karate Museum for 20 years. It was a fun show doing, and you get to hear Wolverine and I kind of go at each other, too. So on behalf of Jesse Bowen, my producer, and all the incredible things he does with the Who's Who in the martial arts, by the way, don't forget to hit your like on Facebook on the AMA Masters Radio blog, and we'll be here next week with our wrap-up show. And as we always say every week, always, always, mahalo and aloha.